the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you...
Hello, this is Athena Melville, your host for Education Now. David Green is my guest in this September 2014 edition as we focus on what good teaching really is. The Common Core, Teach for America, the privatization of public education, and the loss of teacher creativity. David Green's book, Doing the Right Thing, A Teacher Speaks, is a result of his experience and his strong desire to pay forward what he has learned over the years as he continues to fight for public schools. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. So, David, let's just start with the first, you know, what in your opinion, what is good teaching?
Well, we only have an hour, right?
Right.
if we could sort of narrow that down to a soundbite, then we wouldn't be having all the arguments about what good teaching is. I think we all know what good we all know what good teaching is when we see it, when we feel it, when we're in the middle of it, when we walk into a classroom at any level, whether it be from kindergarten to graduate school. We know when the person who is the teacher in the room has your rapture, has your attention, has your passion fired up, and has you intrinsically motivated in what's going on. So to me, it's more about the ability of a teacher to reach their students rather than simply the accumulation of knowledge and then the consummate test-taking following it.
I understand. I understand exactly what you mean, but, you know, when people ask me about curriculum, my opinion is that the teacher is the curriculum. You know, if that teacher is listening and following her students, then she will bring out the curriculum that is right for that student. And for each of them,
yeah,
of course, that requires that she not have, or he, a huge number of students.
Right. You want to be able to have, it's an interesting, you know, quandary. You want to have enough students so that you can have lively discussion, but you don't want to have so many that voices drown themselves out because they are afraid of, you know, that you can't reach them in a room of 36.
Right.
But, you know, you don't want so few that you don't have a wide range of thought and opinion and discussion going
right.
on.
I think the research seems to say that you need at least 10 to create a dynamic. But once you go over 17... retention drops by 70%. This is research that's been out there since the 80s. So you need at least 10 or more to create a dynamic. But once you go over 17, you are really doing a disservice.
Well, it also depends on the level, the grade level, the subject area, the type of teaching methodologies being used. Because oftentimes, you know, when I in high school where I taught, if I had a class that had 17 kids in it, depending upon what we were doing, that would be terrific if it was sort of the regular setting for the classroom. But if I was doing group work and I needed to be able to have, you know, let's say four groups and five roles or six roles within the group, depending upon what the simulations were, the projects were, sometimes you actually do need a little bit more. It just depends on what it is you're trying to do because you understand that kids have different learning styles and you can't always teach the same way. That's another part of being a good teacher. And you have to understand that you have to be able to diversify your approach in having them learn how to learn and to learn the various styles of learning so that, A, they don't get just comfortable in one setting, and they are able to be able to understand that, you know, sometimes I need to work in a group. Sometimes I need to work individually. Sometimes I need to be able to gather information. Other times I need to know now, okay, now that I've gathered it, how do I interpret it and draw conclusions? So there are a lot of ways to do that. And so the way you mix the pot, so to speak, changes the numbers around. So, in the set regular, you know, there's the teacher, here are the student classrooms. I think all of the data that you gave is absolutely correct. But in other settings, different things work differently.
Well, I think that the optimum, you know, if you follow this down, the optimum situation is a teacher and an aide, or two adults, to 24. 2 to 24 is perfect. You know, there are a lot of settings in public schools, and I've had teachers report this on Education Now, where a teacher can't even go to the bathroom. You know, because
you're talking about elementary school.
Yeah, well, I'm talking about schools. Well, you know, where they can't,
because you have breaks between periods.
Yeah, well, you do have breaks between periods in high school, but you still may have kids coming right into you after when that bell rings and kids move to another room. You may have kids coming right into you at that very time. There may be no time for you to do that. These were some of the complaints. But if you have an aide in the classroom, and you have 2 to 24 kids, then, I mean, you know, two adults and 24 kids, it's just perfect. And you can do all the group settings that you want to do with 24 kids, or you could actually ask another teacher and combine two, which would be better than letting them jack up classes into the hundreds. I know that this works because I had a private school, and multi-age groupings also work so beautifully well. But the confidence of the students and the ability to talk and present ideas, which is also very much a part of education that's getting lost in all of this test taking. But I don't want to keep going on and on about this, David. You can tell that I'm really a proponent of a small class size and that there be at least two adults in a classroom.
Given the circumstances, the idea is, you know, it's also which adults you have in the room. I've done, again, my teaching has been exclusively at the high school level, and I have worked in, I've been lucky enough to work in three different high schools where team teaching was encouraged, and group work was encouraged not just between the kids but between the teachers. So we actually would be able to have periods where we would have two, not the teacher and the aide, but two teachers who worked together on developing the curriculum for that particular course, and therefore had the ability to be able to bounce ideas off each other and to model kids how people work in a real-life situation. So I think it's a great idea.
Great. Okay. Speak directly into your phone. It was just a tiny, tiny bit muffled there. Okay.
Sure,
so that's okay. Now let's move into the Common Core. I mean, my audience has heard me speak a great deal about the Common Core and other guests. So let's have your take on the Common Core, Dave.
Well, I think a lot of the reaction to the Common Core is misplaced, because it's the last piece of the puzzle in the ed reformist movement that's been going on that started, you know, more than 20 years ago. And the Common Core, which is what has been pushed
I'm sorry, Dave, but you said which started with something.
Decades ago, there were issues coming up. But the Common Core, this idea of the standardized curriculum, is the latest of a series of attempts by reformers to gain control of education policy. So, you know, go back to No Child Left Behind, there was no Common Core then. You go to the Race to the Top. Common Core came about as a result of Race to the Top. It's only over the last 4 years has been something that we've been having to deal with. But the other issues came up earlier. So it's what I tell people is that Common Core is just one part of the larger issue of who gets to control what gets taught, how it gets taught, who gets to teach it. And it has become the focal point for the attack on the ed reformers. So that's a good thing. The idea that David Coleman and his non-teacher consortiums who put this together back in 2009-2010, sponsored by the National Governors Association and ALEC and all those people, the idea that they could come up with ideas to develop better critical thinking and better ability to do reading and comprehension and all of those things is basically an insult to all the things that we've been doing all along to accomplish those things. So the idea of the generic idea of increasing the ability to do critical thinking and the ability to take information and use it as opposed to being used by it, this is not new stuff. This is just their attempt to control what was going on. There was an article recently in one of our local papers, Lohan, it's a Gannett paper, but it kind of spread around about what was in New York called the lost standards. Well, New York State, for example, has had K-12 syllabi for decades. Even when I was in public school back in the 50s and 60s, they had these K-12 syllabi. But they were flexible. They were guidelines. They weren't mandated. And that's the bigger issue. The fact that these things are mandated and top-down and almost lockstep in how teachers are being asked to approach doing some of these things. So that, to me, is the biggest issue. What standards are, I don't even like the use of the word standards because, to me, they're just using that as a synonym for curriculum because constitutionally and based on federal law, there cannot be a federal or national curriculum. So they can't use the word, but they could certainly use the word standards instead. But when I talk about standards, and I think when most teachers talk about standards, they talk about to the kids in the room, these are the standards I want you to achieve. I want you to be able to move from the level that you're working at now to a higher level, to set a goal and set a series of objectives. It's not a set of curricular standards. So I think one of the good things that's come out of the Common Core, it's pissed a lot more people off than a lot of the things that have gone on for the previous 20 years, and that's good.
Uh-huh. Well, I understand about New York schools in the 50s. I mean, they were the tops. They were number one in the country.
All the way through the 70s, by the way.
And yeah, I know. And in California, we were second only to New York in quality of education. Just fantastic. And it was free here in California all the way through university. So and it all came apart with Reagan. And Prop 13 just pushed it through, at least here in California. So
Because Reagan is the connection. Because when Reagan moved to Washington, D.C., that's when A Nation at Risk was published in 1983.
Uh-huh.
And it's A Nation at Risk's publication in 1983 that really begins to set a lot more of this corporate reform ideas into motion. Then moving on into the 90s with the creation of the global economic/education reform movement, and then the creation of ALEC, and then on and on and on with bringing the Texas version with No Child Left Behind, then the Obama version, Race to the Top, and then Common Core.
Yeah. Well, what I was getting at is that we know how to do it.
Right.
And I know you probably heard all of the talk about why the Finland schools are tops and how they say we learned everything from America. But America just isn't applying it anymore. But we learned everything there. So our teacher prep people here in this country who are getting so much bad press. They have been doing a great job, and that's just more evidence for that. And with the Common Core now, what I'm hearing from science and math teachers is, I love it. What I'm hearing from language people is, I hate it. But what I'm also hearing from math and science people is, I hate it, but I hate the way it's been put out there. I hate that these testing companies are going to make all this money off of it. I hate it that it supports Bill Gates. I hate that part of it. But Athena, you can't believe how great the actual math and science sections are. So that's a conundrum for me.
I think it depends on again, who you've asked and what their personal sets of experiences are. One of the things that's happened as a result of this, and again, I can't do any statistical analysis, but I think there's an age difference, there's an experience difference in the way these things are received. And one of the things that's happened in lots of schools where people are saying, no, this isn't so bad, is that that happens more readily, at least in my observations, in schools where the oral history of teacher preparation has been lost because of the large number of experienced teachers who have left the field over the last 10 years. And teaching is one of those oral history professions. You learn to teach you go to college, you take all the courses, you know, there are certain college courses, whether they be undergraduate or graduate, that are absolutely necessary to understand the basis and the concepts and the ideas behind teaching. But to be able to take those ideas and concepts, like anything theoretical, and put them into application, you need to have guides on the ground. You need to have good, strong mentors, good, strong coaches, good, strong peer counselors, whatever the system is. And there's been a gap. There's been a loss of that oral history of teaching and the mentorship. So that you now have large numbers of schools that have very few experienced teachers, so that the person in charge of, let's say, a fourth grade team is a third year teacher, or the department chair in an eighth grade English course department is a fourth year teacher, who are scrambling, who don't know, who don't have the experienced people or supervisors to be
David,
able to
there's
calm
something,
down.
Dave,
this is how Dave, you do it.
Dave, I hate to interrupt you, but you need to speak directly into your phone, and well, I don't know why, but we were getting some kind of echo, and so
I haven't moved.
Okay, all right, and you are speaking directly into your phone.
Yes, I am.
Okay, well, I understand what you mean, and about not having experienced teachers in the classroom, and I think we'll address that when we talk for Teach for America. But to go back to the Common Core, the persons who like it are teachers who teach teachers math and science. These are college professors who are teaching, you know, educational courses to teachers, right? Prospective teachers. These are not people who are in the classroom for a year and don't have any experience in math or science. These are people who really, these subjects, math and science, are their forte. And so it pains them. It pains them because what's in the Common Core, as far as they're concerned, in the math and science, is excellent. The way it's going to be implemented is terrible and tragic. That's their opinion. But now let's go on to Teach for America, because I think that's what you were talking about, is when they're putting in teachers that have no experience, and some of them have not been through any teacher training program except what Teach for America is providing. Is that right?
That's very true. The The problem of Teach for America is a much larger one. But to go back to what I was saying earlier, that's a small portion of the newer teachers that we're seeing. In 1990, the average length of service, I'm going to use that phrase as opposed to tenure because that becomes a very questionable word these days.
Right.
The average length of service of a teacher in the United States was approximately 15 years. It's now less than 5. Now, all of those people who have left, retired, resigned, given up, forced out, whatever action verb took place that allowed them to leave, they've been replaced by lots of new teachers, and only a small percentage of those have been Teach for America core members. So there's an overall gap. In addition to the fact that you do have Teach for America and other alternative certification people coming in, which are a separate issue, Teach for America's stated goal, is to create leaders in educational policy, far more so than it is to create career teachers. There's a method to their madness and a madness to their method that's making us mad in both meanings of the word. So when you talk about Teach for America teachers, and when I was working at Fordham University, one of my jobs there was to be a mentor or what they call a field specialist to, over the course of 4 years, 19 Teach for America core members who taught in middle schools and high schools in the Bronx. And they were of varying capabilities, talents, reasons to be in teaching. I'm actually fairly happy to say that of the 19, there are 6 or 7 who are still in teaching, and 4 of those started in 2008. So they're actually surpassing the average. But on the whole, there were people that I wanted to continue teaching who went on to med school or went on to get a PhD in psychology. So I can't really argue with them. But there were kids there who should not have been teaching and were in it for the wrong reason. But the issue of Teach for America is one that I think is a flashpoint for a much larger issue, which is, how, under the conditions that have been created in education today, do we get a solid core of dedicated, motivated people who want to be career teachers and not just short-timers, whether it be through Teach for America or not?
Yeah, I have a terrific problem with Teach for America. I just feel like it's... it cuts right to the it cuts the guts right out of teacher training programs through universities.
Which, if you look at
Finland, you realize we really have the cream of the crop in those people who are teaching teachers. And so what we don't really need Teach for America, in my opinion, it was all a creation to undermine the teaching profession at the university level. And I think it's good to have experience in all things, and it's great if you teach, but if you're really in a great system, which we used to have, then you would go into classrooms, even when you were in high school, as an aide or as an assistant and get some experience teaching, or even at the university level, perhaps you were a teaching assistant. That was another way to get some teaching experience. But creating a whole system to put teachers in the classroom, just to me, is disgusting.
It's an interesting quandary. I think what happened is that its original intent, and what it has become, it really has changed dramatically. And I think you're right. I think it has been it's morphed to this policy creation. I mean, when you take a look at now who superintendents are and principals are and policy leaders are, many of them are now people who were core members 20 or more years ago. And these are now the people who are actually leading education policy. There's actually an offshoot of Teach for America. I believe it's called LEE, Leadership Education Enterprise or something like that, the specific goal is to do just that, is to create the policies that you're talking about. But I always had this dichotomy because I was working, I'm a teacher, and at that point I was teaching kids who I thought were being, the core members, who were being used as much as anybody else in this system, because they were dumped, ill-prepared, they were subject to an incredible amount of marketing and hype, which was filled with lies, and they were dumped into these situations in schools that were underwhelming to begin with in a lot of respects. They had poor supervision. As again I said before, there were no experienced teachers to rely on really to help them learn on the job how to be better at what they were doing. And the only person they really had to rely on was me, and I wasn't there on a regular enough basis because I wasn't in the building. I was, you know, I had 8 or 9, or in 1 year I actually had 12 kids, 15 kids, I'm sorry, that I had to go from school to school to school to school. So I didn't have enough time to spend with them individually. But it's a system, it's a program that has hurt kids. It's a program that's hurt teachers. It's a program that, as you said earlier, has hurt teacher training facilities that have been in existence for years, who do, by the way, need to hold up the mirror to themselves and improve some of the things that they were doing. But it's a travesty because it's also been, to me, the biggest travesty is that it's been a means for budget-slashing districts to find ways to get rid of experienced teachers, lower what is obviously the biggest cost in education, which is labor, and not have to worry about pensions because nobody lasts long enough to vest in a pension. So to me, what originally started out as, well, we're gonna supply, you know, it's like temporary, you know, a Peace Corps kind of people to schools that simply they don't have enough teachers because they don't have bodies, and that's morphed into, well, we're going to use Teach for America core members to replace veteran teachers because we've closed 50 schools in Chicago.
Yeah.
And we're going to open up these other schools who are charter schools, and who's going to work in the charter schools? These kids.
Right.
So to me, that's the most onerous piece
right.
of it.
Yeah, there are several problems there. Now, of course, you know, the goals of Teach for America, well, you know, you can say, yeah, those are great goals. So are, you know, who wants to leave any child behind? You know, the rhetoric.
Right.
You know,
nobody,
yeah, right. And racing the top. Who doesn't want
the stated agenda and the hidden agenda?
Right. And who doesn't want their kid to be at the top? I mean, you know, the rhetoric is all there. But, you know, what's that, what are the facts? And which districts are these kids teaching in, right? And these charters happening? These charters are not these kind of wonderful charters that I visit and that I've been to that are small and have been started by parents and teachers, you know, because they wanted that private kind of, that wonderful education that you get in some of the more affluent districts.
Absolutely.
And so they started
in New York City where the charter idea actually started with Albert Shanker, who was the head of the UFT. It was his idea that coming out of the strife between communities and unions that was in the late 60s and early 70s, coming out of that strife and the conversations that took place between all these constituent groups came the idea that what if communities and teachers got together to form their own schools, all right, to be co-led, to be democratically run, to be able to have community and teacher control over what went on there. And I know of people who actually started schools in Brooklyn and the Upper West Side of Manhattan, which are those kinds of charters that were like This is really what the idea was, but once again, an idea taken and morphed into its evil twin.
Yes, it is, by these same profiteers, right? These people who, they use public education, they milk it like a cow. And so that's what the testing corporations do. That's
right.
What the textbooks that don't even mention global warming, at least a few years ago they didn't. I mean, just disgusting. And they're getting all of this public money that should be going to the kids. And
look, in New York, for example, in New York State, Pearson runs everything soup to nuts. They provide, not only do they, at the end game, they provide that they grade, they have test graders, they provide the test, they provide, now they're providing the curriculum, which is Engage New York's version, of Common Core called Engage New York. It's really done by subsidiaries of Pearson. And then all the way down, they have the...
I lost you, David.
So...
Hello.
It's a monopoly, both vertical and horizontal.
I don't know where you went for a while.
No, I didn't go anywhere.
Oh, there was this big gap. But I'll find it when I do the edit.
I swear I haven't budged in
there. Yeah, well, we'll just see what happens. So, yes, and these chain schools, that's what I call them, and they call themselves charters so that you'll get a good takeoff of them if you've seen a good charter, but they're really chain schools, and all of the money is going to the top, not to the
right.
kids,
and
they're being formed in areas of color, in areas of
right.
poverty. So the kids that need the arts the most for expression are not getting it. The
right.
communities that need the individual attention the most are not getting it. It's outrageous, in my opinion.
Well, again, I'm going to use personal experience here. I guess it was nationally known that there was a huge argument between Mayor Bill de Blasio and New York City's new mayor, Bill de Blasio, and Eva Moskowitz, who runs one of those chain charter schools, because he had the audacity to compromise and say, well, we would at least like you to pay rent if you're going to use or share some of our buildings. And she brought him to court. Now, this is a woman who runs 6 or 7 schools who is making $250,000. She's making more than he is and certainly making more than the chancellor of New York City school system. And she runs her schools like prisons, working teachers to the bone who leave really quickly because they just, it's almost like, wage slavery in a lot of respects.
Right. I've had
but
some
exactly,
of those.
That's exactly the point that you're making.
Right. I've had some of those teachers on Education Now, and they talk about how wonderful the kids are, but how they just couldn't take it in that system
right.
anymore, and that so many people who are in positions of authority really need to be in therapy.
Oh, that's so true.
Well, now the privatization of public education, which is really what we've been talking about with these charters, right?
Well, it's more than just the charters. It's Rupert Murdoch several years ago said there was like $500 billion to be made in education if anybody just figured out how to go do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether or not it's charter schools or corporations like Pearson getting all these contracts or digital hardware corporations, Microsoft, Gates Foundation, gee,
right.
I think there's a link to that,
yeah.
creating the software and peddling the hardware to use the software.
Right.
There is so much money to be made in the last public institution that has not been taken over by private corporate entities. And I think that basically they were kind of looking around and said, well, everything else is taken. What's left out on the table we haven't grabbed up yet? And then Murdoch and others said, education. There's a lot of money to be made there. Let's figure out how to do it.
Yeah, I think that the textbook companies, like McGraw-Hill, and which Pearson is just an arm of, they have been onto this for a long time. They have been making so much money. They have been taking that money. When you can go to the original sources, especially with this technology that we have, you can go to the original sources and do your research. You do not need these textbooks.
I'll give you a case in point. We had to, quote-unquote, purchase textbooks. But my kids, this is, again, high school social studies, I said, I don't want to see this textbook. First of all, they're terrible. All right, there are no real good textbooks unless you really go out and search and you have, you know, the Howard Zinn American History books.
Right.
Those kinds of things. Those are good. But most of them, even in the old days, were basically published through the, once they were accepted by the Texas Boards of Education, because Texas and California, as I'm sure you know, were the only two states that purchased wholesale books for the entire state. In New York, for example, districts and schools chose whatever books they wanted. But because the market for textbooks were dominated by both Texas and California, the textbooks chosen by those two states, mostly Texas, were the guides. And so the textbook companies would always put textbooks together that they thought would sell in Texas. Now, you can imagine what that does to American history.
Yeah.
All right. So for years, you know, those of us who kind of were lucky enough to be in districts that we can make choices, said, listen, we're going to take the textbook, you're going to take it home, and you're going to bring it back the last day, but we're going to use primary sources. We're going to use secondary sources. And then with the advent of technology, again, you're lucky enough to be in a district where all kids have equitable and equal access to the technology, then you're right. You can get to those sources. You can do those things. You don't have to read a tertiary version of it. You can get the actual source. So with all due respect to what these privatizers want to do, I want to be able to use their technology, but not on their terms.
Right. That's exactly how I feel. I am not one of those people that feels like technology is bad. I do feel like you can introduce a child to a screen when they're too young. I do believe that. I do believe that hands-on education for the very young is crucial, and so is movement. Moving, you know, is crucial. So, but I love the technology. And the other thing that with the closing of the schools at first, it was sort of like, well, you know, those mausoleums, they cost a fortune to heat. You know, and they're so big and they're not very warm. But so if they would just buy up all those empty homes in neighborhoods and start up these little neighborhood schools, like, which was the promise of public education, and use those big buildings for dance classes or PE or adult ed or something, you know, that would be okay with me. But to just close the schools because they don't have enough bodies, and then to go into another school and say, and we're using these rooms, and so they're not available to you anymore, and we don't.
That's another example of the same kinds of things. How do we use our tools? Now, a building is not the institution. A building is a tool. How you use it and how it's run is an important piece of it, just like the use of technology. The use of understanding how we manipulate the tools and the tools don't manipulate us. How we manipulate the technology doesn't manipulate us. How we manipulate the data, not the data manipulating us. All of those things are really learned, and I love that you use the word experientially.
Yes.
Because we learn as human beings by doing.
That's right.
And too often, we interpret playing on a computer screen as doing, when it's really not doing. You're still reading. You're still observing visuals and responding. It's more Skinner behavioralism than it is anything else. Right. The way most of these things are set up. But a true experiential learning program, I think, is an incredible means. I'm going to use one of the terms that has been usurped from us, transition from one level to another. So we talk about transitional periods from elementary to middle school, from middle school to high school. 40 years ago, in a local high school, teachers created a means to deal with the problems that high school seniors were having with being high school seniors and learning how to get out of the high school box and learning how to live life, whether they became college students or went to work. It was called WISE, and it was called the Woodlands Individualized Senior Experience, with the idea that instead of going to classes, you would get academic credit and go out in the world with a mentor from the school and another mentor from out of school who was an expert in the field that you wanted to work at. It could be an internship, it could be an art project, it could be music, it could be anything. But the idea was that you researched it and you did it simultaneously out of the school building. And the ability of those kids, for 40 years now this program has been in existence, to be able to go out and have an easier transition to their adult life is incredible. And it's an unfortunate situation that creative programs like that are being ignored while we're getting all of this Skinnerized version of what they call experience.
Right.
Dumped on us.
Yes, it is. It's so sad. We're ignoring Finland and the lessons they learned from us. We are ignoring the research. No expert in child growth and development would support what the reformers are doing.
Absolutely.
Not a one.
And your comment earlier about movement, I've done a lot of work on the education of boys and why they're doing so poorly in schools these days.
Right.
There's a correlation between the amount of sit time and test taking and rote kind of material they're doing and their decline in learning, because especially at younger ages they need to move around. They
of
need
course.
To learn
yeah.
through what we used to call apprenticeship.
Right. Well, you know, the hand, everything. If you read Montessori, you know that everything is connected to movement.
Mm-hmm.
The entire growth of the brain, everything is connected to movement. And so not to let children move is a crime. It's really criminal.
It was a crime in the 20s when they started, in the 30s when they started building those screw-in desks based
right.
on Taylor's scientific management, which
right.
was then dumped into schools. And what I tell people is that we haven't progressed in 90 years. We've gone full circle back to that same kind of common core, let's teach the workers how to be obedient kinds of things, which was going on in the early 20th century. As they were preparing workers for the new 20th century jobs. Now they're doing exactly the same thing and they call it the 21st century skills. No, it's not. It's sit down, be obedient, learn to do what the technology tells you to do. Back then it was a conveyor belt, now it's a computer. But
right.
the methodology of trying to train workers to be obedient workers in a substandard system hasn't changed.
Right, but that's not really what teaching is about.
Exactly.
And we know that. And it's also, the only disagreement I have is that we did, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, we were doing a fantastic job in education
Absolutely.
In this country. And why the unions, as soon as No Child Left Behind came out, which goes against best practices, which is a part of every teacher training. Why the unions didn't say, I'm sorry, but we can't do this because it's against best practices. Our teachers can't do this. Why they didn't do it then and fight back?
There has been then and there is now a huge disconnect between union leadership and teachers. In New York State, again, I use the example, when NYSET, New York State Teachers Union, doesn't endorse a pro-teacher candidate who's running against Andrew Cuomo, a clearly anti-teacher candidate, you have to ask questions. And it's
yes.
the same question that you asked about what was going on then as now. And there's a huge debate in New York State with teachers about to pull out what's called Vote COPE, the funding that helps for the legislative lobbying, for NYSET to just pull out of it, because who are they paying for and what kind of decisions are being made at that leadership level? When Michael Milgrew of the UFT is supporting Common Core, one has to ask why.
Right.
You know, if you're supposed to be the leader of the largest local in the country, How can you be doing that?
Yeah, how can you be doing that? It is maddening to me, and I know that I wish that the defamation of character of teachers, that's another thing where I feel like the union should have come out strong and said, you know, we're going to do a lawsuit because this is a defamation of character and we won't have it. And so I've just been really disappointed in the unions, and I just hope teachers, I think Chicago is, it has a good teachers union, and that they're reforming it. Right?
And interestingly enough, I don't know if you know that Karen Lewis, the head of the teachers union, is maybe a mayoral candidate.
Yes, I do know.
In Chicago.
Yeah.
Would be remarkable. And you, I mean, there's a model right there for other organizations to follow.
Right. I sure hope so. Well, we should say goodbye, David. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Well, thanks for having me. This was a great pleasure.
Right. And I hope that people will get your book, Doing the Right Thing, A Teacher Speaks. And thanks again.
I appreciate the time, and it was a wonderful conversation.
Oh, I thank you. Bye-bye now, David.
Bye-bye.
You, who are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know.